restrictive partnership, small partnership before that. We then went public, and Sidney and Henry were the joint chairman, became a public company, which was not really, I expect you probably know that by that time we'd already made an unsuccessful foray into the gilt market.
Yes, Jeffrey Lederman explained Jeff Lederman the story.
Was asked to run it, yes, and it was a failure, and we lost a bit of money, but it was a lot really. But I suppose relatively it was quite expensive, and Sidney and Henry were determined to get some capital out of the firm before they retired, and they had this determination to go public, and so they forced the company, because they were the bosses, the senior partners, to withdraw from the gilt market. And I think really, looking back on it, I don't suppose we saw it at the time, because I agreed, I voted as well to withdraw from the gilt market. It was becoming very expensive. But looking back on it, it's now quite obvious to me that their motives were very selfish, I think. That they really were scared that the public flotation wouldn't come off if we continued to lose money at that rate. Which it probably was right, it probably wouldn't have come off. However, it did the firm a lot of disservice in the longer term, because it's not a market which you can withdraw from and then go back in again. It was very much an old school tie market, and you know, you lost face with the people, the establishment, if you like. Anyhow, we did go public. The flotation was hardly successful, because it came just before the market fell out of bed and the economics all went wrong. In fact, the other firm that wanted to go public at the same time withdrew, which was Aykroyd. And Wed also, I think, were planning to go public, and they aborted it. Anyhow, we went public, and I was then sort of unofficially the chairman-elect, designated, if you like, rather than elect. And Sidney and Henry retired one by one, having got some money out of the flotation. Not a lot by today's standards, but enough. And I took it over, and the first thing I decided was that the firm needed a proper pension fund. We didn't have no pension fund. I set one up for the firm, and I set up a special one for the directors, which was more advantageous than for the office staff. And I also decided that I was very much, I mean, it was a team of us, really. I mean, I became the chairman. There wasn't a lot of discussion about it, because I'd sort of been designated to be the next chairman, really. And I was a little older than Jeff and a lot older than Gerald, and about the same age as our finance director was, David Heath, who was the only one who really opposed me at the time, but eventually he was quite happy about it. And the four of us really ran the business as a team, almost, if you like. And one of the first things I did was to make sure that the people who worked in the company got something out of it. Mm. And so we sort of set up a totally new salary structures, and we started to give company cars out to people, and we sort of became more perk orientated in the company, if you like, from the earnings point of view. And there was I sort of liberated the firm in a sense. They've been very much kept under the people in the business, you know, at that time. Which I think was probably one of the reasons why, I think it was one of the reasons why the firm went on to be successful, because there was a very good morale in the business. There was a feeling in the business that, if people did well, they'd get something out of it. They weren't being kept down, they weren't being restricted all the time. And the firm expanded quite fast after that. And that brings you really up to date, really. That's where we are.
Yes. Which areas were you expanding in? Was it across all the equities?
Well, I opened up offices in New York, and generally the New York expansion was quite significant, obviously, and didn't make any money, but it was an expansion that was hopefully was going to make money at one stage. We did that. We did a number of other things. We sort of generally internationalised the business, in actual fact.
Yes.
You know, and we started looking. I went across to Australia and went to other places, Hong Kong and everything else, and we started to open up small offices there. And, you know, all these things happened really over a period of the next few years.
Was this something that other jobbing firms were also doing?
Not to the same extent, I don't think. Not to the same extent. They went in different directions from us, really. You see, the gilt market was still enormously profitable in those days for the two big firms in it, Wendt Lacquer and Ackroyd. Enormously profitable. And we always had the fact that we couldn't be in it. So we had to try and do something else. We did have our strength in gold shares, but we couldn't match the fortunes that were made at times in the gilts in those days, when, as I say, it was all a slightly protected market in a way, before Big Bang. So I can't recall the sequence of events, but we expanded the business generally. We raised money, we expanded the capital base of the business, and we started to take on larger business. We started to actively compete against the other jobbers, the other major jobbers. Like, where do you see an Ackroyd? There were the five. It had got down really to five major firms in those days. It was Pynchon, Bisgood, ourselves, Wedd and Ackroyd. And the pecking order was something which you could discuss forever. It varied, but what we did was, we were certainly not in the first three. I mean, Pynchon was above us, certainly in size. And Wedd and Ackroyd were both probably joint at the top. Ackroyd became much more successful than Wedd because they started to make a lot more money out of gilt than Wedd did. Pynchon started to come unstuck because they took a Val. I like Val a lot. He's a good friend, Val. He was a trader, but he shouldn't really have been allowed to trade because he was really a very good administrator, Val. Very bright chap, and he understood administration much better than I ever did. But he didn't have a lot of flair for trading, and he led the firm into what I thought was a catastrophic policy, which was basically to be short all the time. And it unfortunately coincided with the market taking off and going up through the roof. And it cost him a fortune, and we slipped quite gently into third place. And then, of course, we did have an abortive move to take over Bisgood, which was a pity. I'd like to take them over. I'm sorry that didn't come about. It was one of the only areas I can actually remember where I was actually defeated in the company, everything I wanted to do. Because it was my plan to take them over, and we went for the Nobby's Commission. I went through 6 months of aggravation, waiting to be cleared to take them over. And then when we got permission to take them over, the company didn't want me to do it.
What, in your view, would have been the advantage of taking over Bisgood?
I think we'd have gone right up with the two majors in size, because we were a complementary firm, you see. We didn't trade the same stocks at all. And I think as a combined firm, we'd probably gone back into the gilt market.
I've been told by people like Geoffrey Lederman that they'd felt at the time that the personalities wouldn't quite mix.
That's exactly the reason why we didn't go ahead.
What was your view on that?
I yielded to it. Well, I was very upset at the time, and I did consider resigning. But then I thought about it to myself, and I thought, well, I'm really cutting my nose off to my face. So I've been defeated on something which I really wanted to do, but it's not the end of the world. I've still got a good business. And I just had to put up with it. I mean, you know, in the end, that was when I had to give way on it. I was very disappointed and upset, and Geoff and I had a rather difficult relationship for a time, but it didn't last. We both got over it. Because I think he was totally wrong, you know, and I still do, looking back. I've often said it, often said that. It was a very destructive move not to go ahead. We'd have jumped up in league size totally, and we'd have probably gone back in gilts.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about the international side of Smith's business and how that contrasted with the traditional jobber broker setup where you'd meet face to face in the floor of the house.
Well, you do the internationals are the same. Not now, I mean everything's different now. But in those days when the floor market was open, it was the same. It was just a different character market. That's all. You've gotten used to dealing with the people who the equity side would never have come into contact with.
Yes. But were you permitted to deal with people outside of the house, like firms in South Africa?
Yes, we were.
Now, how did that work? What I'm asking you is basically the mechanics of the market.
On the telephone. Telephone, I used to speak to regularly to them. And it was more complex than that. I mean, that's a simplification. Yes, we used to deal on the telephone. Sometimes you used to come to a third party who used to deal for them. It was quite a complicated market. I mean, the market mechanism had sort of, it developed itself. The way one actually dealt was just something which grew up and developed. The difference really in the international market was really the fact that you were dealing with people who didn't always see face to face, and you had to learn different techniques. You know, you had to learn different relationships, which we did. And we were quite successful. It was always the strongest part of our business. But of course, at that time also, the equities started to make a lot of money because the industrial boom then started. You know, last 10 years, bull market had started to run. Mm. And there was progressively bigger and bigger business in the equities.
What would have been the disadvantage if you hadn't been able to deal outside of the stock exchange with outside firms? Would it have been that you wouldn't have seen the business?
Yes.
Or you wouldn't have known?
The business wouldn't have come in the stock exchange, and therefore you're always dealing at a disadvantage with only knowing half the facts. I mean, it's not much point in selling short of something if somebody else is buying them outside as well. You're in a double trouble.
Yes.
You've got to see all the business or have a look at it. Some of it's going to go to your competitors. That's fair enough. You can sense that. That's part of the job in business.
Yes. Well, where was more of the business coming from for you? Was it coming from the outside firms or from...
From the outside firms. London by that time had been progressively a seller of gold shares. There many left in London. So all our business really was based on the premise, which we spotted, and that's where we complained to the council. I said, look, London is geographically in the middle of a time zone. It's ideally placed to handle America to South Africa and vice versa. We're in the middle of the time zones. And that was why we built up such a big business with the Americans and South Africa. We just used trade in between them. I mean, they wanted to deal when South Africa was shut, and South Africa wanted to deal when America was shut, and we were there in the time zone. So we were able to trade and make prices to both parties.
Well, where did the brokers here fit into the thing? Were they at a disadvantage because they were bound to charge commission?
Yes.
So they weren't able to compete with...
Well, they didn't have any business in those stocks. I mean, the arbitrage by that time, you see, was disappearing because communications were so good then, there were never margins. I mean, it's very unlikely that there would ever be actually a market price in South Africa that would be different from ours. The difference was that the South African market itself was very small and is very small now. And all their big gold business, gold share business or finance house business is always done with London because we're the only people that would take them on. I mean, they can't go in their own local market, it's a 100 share market. So they all got into the habit of calling us in London or somebody else, whatever, and trading in London. That's always been so. They don't have a jobbing system over in South Africa. We tried to introduce one, they wouldn't have it. We were quite happy to open up in South Africa, actually. It's one of the things that we actually wanted to do, and to actually institute a jobbing system in their market. And they wouldn't let us do it.
About when was that? Was that after you became chairman?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, what was the feeling in the firm when Parkinson came to his agreement with Goodison and... fixed commissions were going to be abolished and single capacity was going to come to an end?
Feeling in the firm was, well, first of all, there was a feeling of great uncertainty as to what would happen, because up to this very day, I have never, and I've discussed this obviously for endless hours, I have never seen the connection between the abolition of the minimum commission and the abolition of single capacity. I've never understood the connection. It was one of these academic arguments that was raised at the time, and it became the popular argument. Therefore, all of a sudden, we found ourselves having to be dual capacity. But I could never see the necessity to. It happened in America. I mean, the specialist systems carried on in the States just the same, despite negotiated commissions. But for some reason, Goodison, who I have a profound disrespect for in most occasions, most things, because I think he was an academician. Is that right?
Yes.
And not a businessman. And he tossed up all these theoretical arguments, but they were not practical arguments. And I think he did more, if you like, to force the present situation, which I think... I won't describe it as a disaster, because in our own case, it's been very successful, because I just happen to think that we've done it one way, other firms have done it a different way. But I think that what we did was to certainly build something that reflected the time, so we have to take advantage of whatever the circumstances were. But I don't think we should ever have been put in that position. I think we should have carried on as a market maker, if we wanted to. I never saw the connection.
Have any of the conventional arguments behind the abolition of single capacity, did they ever strike you as problems for Smiths? For example, people have said that jobbing firms were undercapitalised.
I think that I don't think that I can recall the firm ever being undercapitalized. There have been times when we were strapped for cash at various times if something came along. That's perfectly true. But then I think most city firms, not just jobbers, brokers were far more undercapitalized than the jobbers. the problem was that they had no need for capital in the normal operation of their businesses, you see. The jobber did have need, but only on rare occasions were we undercapitalized, which is not much of any other industrial company either. We've never ever had to turn a deal down for not having access to the cash. Although we've had skated pretty thin at times. I won't say that we haven't. I'm sure most jobbers have, that's perfectly true. That's the reason. We were never really undercapitalized once we converted to being a company. Mm-hmm. We had access to capital. The trouble is a partnership is always undercapitalized by definition. Mm. And that's one of the most sad things that happened, I think, in this when Big Bang came, because I think that the losses and everything else that have taken place in the city since then really come about really because investing institutions such as banks, which was companies and anything else, didn't perceive when they started to move into the security business, they never perceived the simple fact that a partnership has no assets. And they paid most ludicrous sums of money for nothing. They weren't buying anything. Because then they compounded it by paying the guys off and telling them to retire. Mm-hmm. Well, I asked the question, what the hell have you bought? Mm-hmm. I mean, what did they buy when they paid $100 million for Wed Delacca? I remember my old friend Dick Wilkins, you know, who was this. He said to me, well, you know, we made 20 million last year. I said, Dick, you didn't make 20 million, you didn't make a penny. I said, partnerships can't make a profit because it's split between the partners. There isn't any profit. And I said, that's 20 million before you paid yourselves. But the banks fell for it. They go over, trot around the banks and make 20 million. So they give them 100 million for their business. I don't think WED, if they'd paid themselves what we paid ourselves as a company, as company directors, would have actually had a profit at all. Because they had 75 partners. There's not much left of 20 million after that. The banks fell for it, and not only that, they then gave them handsome payoffs to retire. So you tell me what's clever about that. That's why the most successful firm of all is the Warburg one. Because Warburgs didn't do that. They were a company already. So nobody got big handouts when Warburgs taken over. It was a corporate transaction. You can only sell your business once. Once you've gone public, then you've sold it. Which is what we were in that position. So we couldn't see any possibility of us attracting a large predator who'd give us a fortune for our shares because we were not big equity holders. It seemed to be more sensible to keep with the ethos of the company and remain independent where we run our own business. But we got extra capital. We took in Rothschilds as a major shareholder, and that's given us access to the capital that we needed to expand the company, which we did. But they've never interfered in our management. They've never interfered in any way in the running of the company. We have remained independent, and I hope we'll always do so, although it won't be up to me, but I mean, I hope we do.
Well, let me ask you a few concluding questions. What would you say it had taken to be a successful jobber?
You're talking about a job in the old days, in the markets. You had to have, I think, the same question will be asked, what makes a successful card player? You have to have a flair. You can't teach somebody to play cards. They're either a good card player or they're not. And it's jobbing was exactly the same. You had to be born with some sort of a flair, which you might not have been aware of until you actually tried doing it. But you had to have an instinctive flair, and you had to enjoy the thrill and the cut and thrust of outwitting somebody to some extent. And you also had to have a certain amount of courage. You had to think you were right and be prepared to back it. I don't think there's really much else you needed.
Can you think of cases when you've had to have courage? And
yes, I remember there was an occasion. I mean, an odd occasion, if you like, and I don't remember all the circumstances now. It's too long ago, but I remember when there was a takeover bid in the equity market. I mean, and we were joint at that time with WED, because they dealt in one of the stocks and we dealt in the bidding stock or vice versa. And I remember it was Raleigh Brothers and Jim Slater was involved. Bowater and Raleigh Brothers, I think it was. They dealt in one thing and we dealt in the other, so we went joint. And it was like, you know, one stock was worth an exact amount of money to the other stock. You know, there was like a hedge situation. And we'd buy the Raleigh, they'd sell the Bowater, whatever it was, and the thing was hedged. I can't really remember the exact circumstances, but I do remember one morning that we read the paper and Jim Slater had entered the scene and totally bugger up our market. You know, it looked like it was going to be very expensive. It totally upset the apple cart by overbidding for the other company or something, and we were short of that one, and the other one had gone down as well. You know, and we both Wed and us had a very bad position. And I remember going down to Lyons Long Room in those days in Fort Morton Street, and I was walking down there, and his partner with Wed was sitting down there. Me over, he said, well, we've got a problem with this. What are we going to do about these two books? It wasn't my particular book, but I was just before I became chairman. And I obviously knew the situation as a partner of the firm. And I said, well, I don't know. I said, I don't know, sir. It's going to be very expensive, about £500,000 wrong or something. I said, let's sort of just think about it a bit. He said, well, I think we'll have to cut them. It looks like we're on the wrong foot. I said, okay, well, I said, listen, I'm just going to have a cup of coffee and talk it over with my partners. I sat down, suddenly had a blinding flash of inspiration. I sat there, I thought, I want to cut this one. This is absolutely not. This is going to work out great. And I explained why I thought that to Cindy Davis and Henry Marks, and they agreed. They said, yes. I think you're probably right. Went back to see this partner and we said, look, we would like not to cut this position. Because, and I explained what my thoughts were. And he said, yes, I think you're right, we won't cut them. 2 days went by and he lost his nerve. And he came back and said, I want to cut them. I want to cut the position. Now I said, well, they're a partner, we're joint with them. Feels that way, we've got to go along with it. But I think he's absolutely, totally and absolutely wrong. I think we should hold it. And we did cut them. That was against my wishes and will, and we were absolutely right. About 2 weeks later, it came absolutely good. We'd have made that £500,000 back and more if we'd held the stock of the positions that we really have. But we'd already cut them, so it was too late to do anything about it. But it got me brownie points. As far as that's concerned, you just got to sometimes, if you think you're right, you've just got to be, you've got to have the courage of your convictions. Mm. I've had a few occasions when I have, and I've been convinced I was right in something, holding a position or taking a position, feeling very bullish and sticking to my guns, or feeling bearish and sticking to my guns. You know, you've just got to have a little bit of guts, that's all. I think that's all it really comes down to.
Well, finally, just in a few sentences, what would you say had been the strengths of the jobbing system?
The strength of the jobbing system was that it was, I think it had integrity, for one thing, and it did lead to a very fluid and liquid market in the stocks, in the main stocks. It did do much more liquid than any other system in the world had ever shown it could do, because the job was prepared to be at risk and had to be at risk. There was an awful lot of ill-informed comment in the press at various times about the jobbing system. It really wasn't informed because the press, the media, always, whenever things went wrong, like the market went flat or was whatever, you know, always say the jobbers marked them down, the jobbers are this. What has never been understood about a jobber is that you've got to learn, first thing you learn as a jobber is that no man is big enough or powerful enough to run a market for more than a minute. That's about it. You know, you can either hold a market up or you can either keep it down for more than maybe a fleeting instant. It's not big enough. Markets are bigger than any individual. And they always attributed any problems in the city to the jobbers, either bidding things up or marking things down. In actual fact, markets are really only a reflection of supply and demand. Markets are not a living thing. It's an absolutely dead thing. It's nothing. It's a reflection. And, you know, so that sort of comment was always ill-informed. You know, if they'd ever said, you know, the public, the sellers or buyers, or that's accurate, because that's what it is. It's not the jobbers or the market. We are purely there. We are, if you like, a buffer, in a sense. That's what a jobber does. And the problem now, you see, now you've got no jobbing system, is that while there is, absolutely correctly, there is a reasonable liquidity in the leading stocks, there's no liquidity in the others at all. Secondly, you know, the beta, the gamma, the delta, so you forget them. You can't deal. No market. We always could when there was a jobbing system. There was a considerable degree of liquidity in the secondary stocks that's gone. And I, other than that, I mean, I'm not conceited about being a jobber. I mean, it's just it was a profession and a living which I really enjoyed. So I don't, there's no high morals about it. I was first and foremost a trader and a businessman trying to make money.
Good. I think we'll finish on that note. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.